NBC News presents tonight the fourth of the series, The President in Europe. This is Leon Pearson. President Kennedy tonight has come to the end of the first mile, or should we say the first kilometer. He has been entirely among friends. Tomorrow he crosses the Bridge of Sighs into fateful conversations with an adversary. Our report this evening aims to bring you an appraisal, a realistic appraisal, of the conversations with President de Gaulle and to project into the encounter with that wily and resourceful foe who awaits him in Vienna. It is the practice of diplomacy to write an epilogue to an official meeting by issuing a communique. Here is Sander van Oker in Paris.
The official communique issued today at the end of the talks between Presidents Kennedy and de Gaulle was not rich in specifics. These communiques never are. But it did say there had been frank and searching talks between the two presidents, which covered a wide range of problems. The Soviet Union, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, including aid to underdeveloped countries. These conversations, said the community, had shown the fundamental agreement which exists between the two presidents. In particular, President de Gaulle and President Kennedy confirmed the identity of their views on their commitments and responsibilities toward Berlin. The communique also said the conversations had allowed both presidents to know each other and to set forth fully the respective position of the two countries, taking into account the interests and responsibilities incumbent upon each of them. Left unsaid in the communique was that one agreement reached was for better consultations between the two countries in the future. Sander van Oker, NBC News, Paris.
A communique of another kind comes to us in a Reuters dispatch from Paris. Reuters, the British news agency. For 20 years, Harold King has been Reuters bureau chief in the French capital. Tonight he writes, and I quote this particularly because it is a British view of our president, not an American, President Kennedy won the deep respect of France's often austere leader, General Charles de Gaulle. And another quote, the success of the president's visit went far beyond the popular acclaim he received from the people of Paris. For 2 days past, we've been reporting to you that the two presidents avoided the obstacles that lay between them. Tonight, John Rich in Paris considers this, but with another factor added.
President Kennedy has successfully completed the first leg of his European trip. In a few hours, he heads for Vienna and a much tougher challenge. He disclosed today that he expects Nikita Khrushchev to press him hard this weekend on the subject of divided Berlin. In turn, he's going to make clear that agreement for a ban on nuclear testing must come before any general world disarmament for which Khrushchev is pushing. The president revealed this insight into his thinking for the Vienna meeting as he wound up a 3-day state visit to France, one which both sides are describing tonight as extremely successful. In a clear warning to Khrushchev, President Kennedy said in his speech today that both he and de Gaulle agree they would feel it inappropriate to have their statutory rights in Berlin changed by force or the threat of force. He said he still has strong hopes that a ban on nuclear testing can be reached at the conference in Geneva. And he adds that if we can't reach an agreement on that subject, how is it going to be possible for us to set up the kind of inspection system for control of other weapons? The president has been deeply engaged in a working dinner all evening at the American Embassy residence here in Paris. His top advisors are now here mapping out strategy for Vienna. Dean Rusk, Averill Harriman, Arthur Dean, Ambassador Thompson from Moscow all are on hand, and they take off for Vienna in the morning. The meetings with de Gaulle came to a successful conclusion late this afternoon. The communique stresses friendship and cooperation. Mr. Kennedy himself said that he goes on to Vienna, his confidence bolstered by his visit to Paris. The French tonight appear tremendously happy. There was straight talking on both sides, and the communique indicates they covered a wide range of subjects. There were differences between the young president and the aloof old general, and nobody here is trying to conceal them. But at least the air has been cleared, and both sides now know where they stand. There will probably be a much more direct line from now on between the White House and the Élysée Palace. This is John Rich, NBC News, Paris.
It was a touchy business for the president to hold a conference with newsmen as he did today, and he was obliged to handle some of the hot ones by tossing them neatly aside. There was a question, have you discussed with General de Gaulle the French atomic tests? To which he said, quite candidly, we have discussed these matters. But then the questioner wanted to know when the president would be free under the McMahon law to pass along U.S. secrets to France. Well, here Mr. Kennedy's answer was a rather amusing exercise in evasion, ending with a line, I hope that those of you whom I leave less than satisfied will at least be sympathetic. At the opening of this news conference, by the way, the president identified himself by saying, "I am the person who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I have enjoyed it." Now, some questions, as asked, with answers in the president's own voice.
What, in your opinion, Mr. President, is the principal aim of a meeting with Mr. Khrushchev at this time? And do you feel that you are meeting him with enough cards in your hand?
The purpose of this meeting is to permit me to make a more precise judgment on those matters which involve the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union and those countries which are associated with us and those countries which are members of the Sino-Soviet bloc. We are involved in two conferences at Geneva. We hope that more progress can be made at both of them. And if there is any thing that may be said in the meetings at Saturday and Sunday, which may improve that prospect, then of course that makes the trip worthwhile. There are other matters also on which we have not come to an agreement with Mr. Khrushchev. And I think it important that we understand fully his viewpoint and all of its implications, and that in return he has the same understanding of our viewpoint. I think that it's most valuable to talk to those with whom we're allied. I also think it's important that we talk to those who are separated from us, because in the final analysis, heavy decisions rest constitutionally upon the President of the United States. He must, under some conditions, make the final judgment himself. And if my judgment may be more lucid, as we may be based more on reality as a result of this exchange, then I think the trip would be useful.
That phrase, "those separated from us," deserves a comment of its own, but later. There was another tough question about China.
Mr. President, how can communist China normalize her relations with the West and be admitted to United Nations membership?
I would say that the normalization of relations, which of course, peaceful relations, which is in the common interest of us all between China and the West, I would hope that they would be brought about. But we desire peace, and we desire to live in amity with the Chinese people. But I will say that since long before I assumed office, and in the first days of our new administration, before really any actions were taken, the attacks upon our government and the United States were constant, immediate, and in many cases malevolent. The debate which took place last fall in the between communist parties indicated that the Chinese planned to take an extremely belligerent attitude and role towards us and those with whom we're associated. We hope that policy changes. We want goodwill, but it takes two to make peace. And I'm hopeful that the Chinese will be persuaded that a peaceful existence with its neighbors represents the best hope for us all. We would welcome it, but I do not see evidence of it today.
A moment ago, Mr. Kennedy said, "We must talk to our allies and to those separated from us." And now about Red China, he avoided in his answer the use of the phrase Red China. Obviously, he has in mind the approaching encounter with Khrushchev. Small things can be offensive. He referred to the communists not as our enemies, but as those separated from us. No concession here, no narrowing of the conflict, but an avoidance of offense as the meeting begins. He has in mind, of course, the offense taken by Mr. Khrushchev a year ago of the U-2 incident, which wrecked the Paris meeting with President Eisenhower. Mrs. Kennedy has been very much in the picture, as you know, and she will be again tomorrow when she meets Madame Khrushchev. Let's hear from Sander Van Oker, NBC News in Paris.
Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy leaves with her husband tomorrow morning for Vienna, where people live on memories and whipped cream. Vienna is the city of the Habsburgs, and even though they intermarried with French nobility for centuries, the Viennese are going to have to stretch their imaginations, which they're perfectly capable of doing, to find a link between themselves and French-descended Jacqueline Kennedy. In Paris, there was no such problem. Nothing pleases the French more than to see someone else who's French or at least who has some French blood, never mind how far back. If they are also chic and can speak French with hardly an accent, this persuades the French the person must be worthy of their consideration and attention. They are not convinced many outsiders are. Everything she's done has attracted attention. Was her hair really cut short by her French hairdresser for the ball at Versailles last night? Not since Samson was shorn of his locks has tonsorial technique been so widely discussed. Was she really as beautiful in person as she seemed to be in her pictures? The answer, obviously, has been yes. The last refuge of a weary reporter is to quote something a taxi driver told him. Taxi drivers, as a breed, have in folklore acquired the collective wisdom of the centuries. Voltaire's on four wheels. We will shun that device tonight. Instead, we relate what one of our NBC drivers, so help us, told us tonight. She is so lovely, he said, so much more lovely and fresh-looking when you see her in person than in pictures. She struck the right note throughout, taking time out to send a telegram to wire her condolences to the family of 19-year-old Danielle Bouvier, her distant relative killed Monday on her way to Paris in the hope of meeting the First Lady. Today in the rain, she came out of an impressionist art gallery. Tourists had been waiting in the rain to see her. She brushed by her police escort to step to the edge of the crowd to allow the people in it to take pictures with their cameras. She seems not to have disappointed anyone, except perhaps the French fashion houses. She wore only one French creation, a gown by Givenchy. The rest came from America. She's apparently following the president's injunction to American tourists to spend more of their money at home. Sander Van Oker, NBC News, Paris.
One news dispatch about Mrs. Kennedy and the sidewalk photographers says they expressed their gratitude after snapping their photos by crying out, "Merci, Jacqueline!" But did they? A French lady here in New York, hearing this report, said, "Impossible! The French could never be so discourteous as to call the president's wife by her first name." Well, perhaps some of them did, thinking it was a good American custom. The original plan called for the Kennedys to move today from their official quarters in the Quai d'Orsay to the residence of the U.S. Ambassador, James Gavin. But packing was such a problem, especially for Mrs. Kennedy, with 40 pieces of baggage, that they accepted the proposal to remain where they are and to pack only once. The baggage Mr. Kennedy will require beginning tomorrow is more concisely packed. What does he look like by comparison with Chairman Khrushchev? Irving R. Levine, who has served in Moscow, is now in Vienna.
If opposites attract in politics as well as in romance, Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy should get along famously. They are completely different in age, education, family background. Khrushchev, at 67, is old enough to be Mr. Kennedy's father. The Soviet leader began his formal education only at the age of 27 and never got close to the Soviet equivalent of Harvard. Khrushchev was born of a peasant family, worked as a shepherd, miner, and plumber to earn a living. President Kennedy was born with a silver swimming pool. Yet the men do have something in common. Both are energetic, and although Khrushchev said that life is short and man should live it to the fullest, the words well reflect the competitiveness of the Kennedys. Both have a sense of humor which could save their meetings from head-on collision. Both like power and are sensitive to the realities of personal power. That bodes ill because Khrushchev is not much impressed by failures in Laos and Cuba. Khrushchev once expressed surprise that a man so young and relatively inexperienced in government could become America's president. In conversations with diplomats, Khrushchev reflects no great respect for Mr. Kennedy. Their confrontation could change this, yet right now, Khrushchev may share the opinion that in seeking a meeting with him now, Mr. Kennedy is like a boxer who has just lost his last two bouts with sparring partners and is now challenging the champion. This is Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Vienna.
If you or I were in Khrushchev's shoes, we should be well prepared for one thing. President Kennedy has said at almost every milepost on his route to Vienna, "I want to avoid the danger of miscalculation." He said it in Washington before he left. He said it more than once in Paris. And today, very precisely, he said the most recent miscalculation was in Korea. And here's a quotation, where the North Koreans did not seem certain that we would respond immediately upon the occasion of their invasion into South Korea. Well, the next time this is said, it will be said directly to Nikita Khrushchev, and most probably in connection with Berlin. Khrushchev arrived in Vienna in time to rest and reflect. This might be something to reflect upon. Martin Agronsky in Vienna gives us the arrival scene.
Nikita Khrushchev tonight is doing here in Vienna what for him usually doesn't come naturally. On the eve of the two-day meeting he begins tomorrow with President Kennedy, Mr. K is spending a quiet evening in the palatial mansion maintained by the Russian embassy in the suburb of Pürkersdorf, 10 miles outside of the city. After a half hour spent in the rays of the setting sun in the mansion's quiet garden, the Russian premier appeared to wave a good night to the crowd of waiting reporters, then retired inside. The official motorcycle escort was dismissed. The Khrushchev's daughter-in-law, Ilyena, went off to the opera. Four Russians, each equipped with briefcases, arrived to join their chief. And so far, all's quiet in the imperial yellow Soviet country residence at 17 Ventergasse Street, Pürkersdorf. Since Mr. K has demonstrated repeatedly in the past that he is a master of the unexpected at international conferences, no one would really be very surprised to see his stocky, short-legged figure bouncing along the streets of this city tonight. It could be, though, that the rather cool welcome extended by the people of Vienna when he arrived this afternoon influenced Mr. K to take it easy. The official reception left nothing to be desired in the way of protocol and ceremonial. But the small crowd of Viennese who turned out at the railway station to greet Mr. K missed a few boos with some conspicuously weak tears as he professed his desire for peace and to get to know Mr. Kennedy better. The Russian, in his formal visit to Austria's President Scharf, did not neglect the opportunity to pop out on the balcony outside the president's office. But the Viennese proved a lackadaisical Romeos for Russia's ebullient Juliet, and Mr. K cut short his Viennese balcony scene. This is Martin Agronsky, NBC News, Vienna.
Now in the final moments, return to Paris. We have saved for the last a portion of the president's news conference. In fact, the opening statement made before the questions popped. We've saved this because it states so clearly what he sees as the stepladder of progress with the Soviets. You can't take the second step until you have taken the first. John Rich mentioned this a moment ago. If we cannot have an agreement on a nuclear test ban, which is relatively simple, how can we go on to the larger question of disarmament involving the same sticking point of inspection? Well, here it is directly in the words of the president.
I come on the same mission which occupied many of my predecessors, stretching all the way back to President Wilson at the conclusion of the First World War. And that is how it is possible to bind more intimately for the common interest France and the United States, Europe and the United States. All of the power relationships in the world have changed in the last 15 years, and therefore our policies must take these changes into account. First is the change in Europe itself. In the 1940s, Europe, much of it was destroyed, its productive capacity liquidated, divided by a bitter war, inflation rampant, and only those who were optimists of the most extreme sort could have ever predicted the astonishing renaissance of Western Europe today. The second great change is the change in weaponry. The United States no longer has a nuclear monopoly. The Soviet Union's possession of atomic and hydrogen weapons has increased its willingness to test and probe and push the West. We still have strong hopes that it will be possible for us to reach an agreement at Geneva on a cessation of nuclear tests. If we cannot reach an agreement on this subject, which is relatively easy to patrol because of the flow of radiation, how is it going to be possible for us to set up the kind of inspection system for the control of other weapons which could lead to disarmament and therefore to a world peace? I consider this to be a most essential, realistic step. Third and most important is the change in the location and the nature of the threat. The cause of freedom is under pressure all over the world, but because of the extraordinary rebirth of Western European strength, the struggle has been switched to other areas where the security of your countries and mine are now being directly threatened. The time has now come for us to associate more closely together than ever in the past in a massive and concerted attack
on poverty, injustice, and oppression, which overshadow so much of the globe. We are not spectators today. We are all contributing. We are all involved here in this country, here in this community, here in Western Europe, here in my own country, here all around the globe, where it is our responsibility to make a maximum contribution.
That phrase, a massive attack on poverty, constantly returns in the president's thinking, as indeed it did with President Eisenhower. Before we leave Paris, consider the rather remarkable fact that President Kennedy and President de Gaulle have held their series of conversations practically alone, that is, only with interpreters, not with foreign ministers or other advisors. I think this is important in making any appraisal of the success or failure of the encounter. They did fail to reach an agreement on the French contribution to NATO. They did fail to reach an agreement on the sharing of U.S. atomic secrets. They did fail to reach an agreement on French testing of their own atomic weapons. But we cannot draw the conclusion that the conference was a failure unless we assume that they expected to agree on these problems. If they had, they would have come to these meetings with advisors and technicians prepared to discuss details. No, apparently the purpose was for each to take the measure of the other man. In France, de Gaulle is the state, with foreign policy firmly in his own hands. President Kennedy, much more than President Eisenhower, is acting as his own Secretary of State. Dean Rusk did not come to Paris until last night. Between two men of power, in two countries of importance, it was vital that they should establish, as John Rich just put it, a direct line from the White House to the Élysée Palace. And we can hope that Harold King was right when he wrote today, President Kennedy won the deep respect of France's often austere leader. Well, tomorrow to Vienna. It may be a romantic notion, but what a fine world it would be if such an agreement could be reached between the West and Russia that the massive attack on poverty, which Mr. Kennedy spoke about today, could be made jointly rather than in competition. I recall that President Eisenhower, in his first year in office, told the American Society of Newspaper Editors that if the Russians would permit it, we would beat our swords into plowshares and devote the cost of making war to the benefit of the needy peoples of the world. This is Leon Pearson, NBC News.
This has been the fourth and final NBC News report this week on the President in Europe, presented on the NBC Radio Network. On Monday, NBC News will present a summary report on the journey of President Kennedy to see President de Gaulle of France, confer with Russian Premier Khrushchev in Vienna, and wind up meeting Prime Minister Macmillan in London. On the weekend, NBC's Monitor will continue coverage of the Kennedy-Khrushchev meeting with spot news and in-depth reports. The President in Europe was produced by NBC News. Producers Ray Hassan and Art Wakely. Director Daniel Sutter. Every Sunday, a review of the week's news on Weekend Report on many of these NBC stations.